Welcome to Hour 2 of In the Moment. I'm Kara Hetland in today for Lori Walsh. Thanks so much for joining us. And it's Wednesday and time for our Dakota Political Junkies. And joining me now is Seth Tupper from the Rapid City Journal, watchdog reporter, enterprise reporter, and our political junkie. Seth Tupper, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with some things that are happening in Pierre. We've seen a little softening, I would like to call it, of the governor's position on the Spearfish Canyon.
Yeah. That would be putting it politely. I kind of liken, you know, it's the proposal seems to be kind of in limbo right now. It's kind of like a zombie. It sort of looks dead, but it's still up walking around, you know. the last Friday, the governor had a press conference, and I called in and asked him about the status of the plan, because recently the state held its first public input meeting on the park proposal in Spearfish, and an angry mob basically showed up and said, "We want no part of this." So there was an estimated 400 people there, carrying signs, and they were very agitated, very passionately against this state park proposal. So in light of that, I asked the governor, you know, are you going to shut this down, or are you going to continue pushing onward? And his response was kind of a resigned tone and said, well, we might not even have enough money for it anyway this year, and because the sales tax projections are down and trending downward, and the state needs about $2.5 million to throw into basically the land deal. There's a swap of state and federal land they need to carry out, and part of the cost of that would be $2.5 million, and the governor isn't sure that money's going to be there. So he didn't say that the plan is dead, but he also didn't say he's going to continue pushing it. So it's kind of in limbo at this point, and I'm not sure exactly what'll happen to it. There is a bill to carry out to appropriate the $2.5 million in the legislature, but the last I checked, that hasn't been scheduled for a hearing. It's just kind of sitting there, and I think
so. There isn't any motion on the. I mean, things are just standing still.
Things have stopped. Yeah, there was motion on it for the last year and a half, and things were going forward. There was a bill in Congress. Do the federal state land swap. You haven't heard much at all about that lately. And there was going to be a schedule of public hearings. Well, after the first one, that's kind of been put on hold. As far as I understand, there aren't any more scheduled now that I know of. So, like I said, so you can't really say it's dead, but it's certainly it's been paused, so to speak.
Can there still be a land swap? I mean, can some pieces of this still kind of play out without making it a state park?
Yeah, and that's what's interesting is, you know, some people may be aware or may not be aware that, you know, the state already has significant holdings in Spearfish Canyon. The state owns Rough Lock Falls and it's already been designated as a state nature area. The state owns Spearfish Falls and some other land, like a little pond there. The state has actually been, you know, probably deserves more credit than it's gotten for having acquired some of that land over the years from its former owner, which was Homestake. And so they've been able to preserve some of that land and keep public access there. But to create the state park, they wanted a significant chunk of what's now national forest land to go with it. And I suppose theoretically they could ram that bill through Congress. Our congressional delegation had been in favor of it. And we have a Republican Congress, Republican president now. But anytime you get, 400 people, potential voters together and are very angry and say, we don't want you to do this, obviously politicians are probably a little wary to proceed then against those wishes.
For every issue? No, I'm kidding. That's just so
well, I would, yeah, I would say so, but especially this one. I mean, one of the things that makes this so unique is that, this wasn't just anybody opposing. These were the people that live right there, the canyon's in their backyard. So, I don't think it's dead forever. I mean, maybe there's some way that the governor can start over and maybe conduct some private conversations and maybe come up with a plan that'll be more palatable. But it really ran into from his view, an unanticipated wall of opposition at this point.
And Dana Ferguson from the Sioux Falls Argus Leader joins us now. Hi, Dana. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Sorry I'm late.
That's okay. Let's start the topic with you about the repeal of IM-22 last week. What's the politics behind it?
Yeah. So it's been a big couple of weeks, as you can imagine, out here in Pierre, as there's been a pretty strong sense of opposition among Republican lawmakers wanting to get rid of initiated Measure 22. We heard that very, very early on, basically as soon as it passed by a pretty narrow margin in November. Then the governor was quick to say that voters were hoodwinked by campaigners who worked on that. And then Republican lawmakers were quick to file their lawsuit challenging that law as unconstitutional. It was held up in court, put on hold, and within about a week, it was submitted as a bill to repeal that law. And I think it was just about 7 or 8 legislative days later, it was off the books. The governor repealed it. And in the meantime, there was a bit of fanfare at the Capitol here as opponents to repeal were really working to let lawmakers know that they weren't happy about what they were doing. Lawmakers received letters, emails, phone calls, and some got threats from those who were unhappy about their move to repeal the law that South Dakota voters approved. So quite a bit of drama. Now we're in the process of watching legislators here bring their replacement bills. There are about 18 that deal exclusively with pieces of initiated Measure 22 and what lawmakers think that meant to do or what voters wanted it to do when they voted for it. And those have come up all week. They will likely be the biggest topic of conversation during the last 20-some days, if not less than that, of the legislative session that we have left.
I'm wondering, Dana, if every issue addressed in IM-22 is addressed in those 18 proposals. Are they leaving some out?
They are leaving some out. There was a sense among lawmakers that no one, at least no one who reached out to them, really wanted to see what was called a democracy credit program come back. The governor in his budget address back in December essentially said, we can either have this democracy credit program that would provide a certain number of voters in the state $250 credits that would let them essentially give those to the political campaigns of their choice. And then that would be on the state to come up with the money. Governor Dugard said either we can use about $4 million that would be needed for that program to pay for increases to education, health care, and state employees, or we can use the money for the Democracy Credit Program. And while there's been some blowback toward legislators who repealed IM-22, they say there's not been a desire among constituents to bring back some sort of replacement for that program. So South Dakotans can't expect to see that soon. The governor and legislators said if voters do want that, they should consider bringing it as a ballot initiative. And I think that would really signal to them, maybe you don't understand exactly what voters wanted if they're not the ones bringing a replacement for that.
And Seth Tupper, I'm wondering the blowback, as Dana called it, from constituents, is that going to our lawmakers concerned? Should they be concerned about that?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, there's always this idea that, you know, gee, if lawmakers repeal a measure that voters recently passed, the voters would be really angry about that. But yet we see year after year that it doesn't seem to translate to the ballot box as far as individual candidates. I mean, we have Republican control of the legislature. Their numbers increase year after year, and their majority gets stronger and stronger. And yet they're the ones who are doing these kinds of things. We've had this happen in the past, maybe not on this scale, but, you know, for example, with the minimum wage increase, you know, there was a repeal of or a change to that. Voters approved the increase in minimum wage. The legislature came back and tried to take away part of it for kids or you know, young adult workers, and then the voters put that back in. And so there seems to be a disconnect. While, you know, the voters at large are maybe not happy with the legislators, you know, changing or repealing laws that voters have passed, they also seem perfectly willing to send those same legislators back to peer and separate those two things. So while you would think that maybe they should be worried, the real world results and the results at the in the elections don't seem to bear that out.
Let's move on to another topic. We saw the mental health reform legislation drop this last week, Dana.
We did. So we're starting to see pieces of Justice Gilbertson's proposal come down and seeing those work their way through the State House. Essentially, a good chunk of those proposals stemmed from an Argus Leader media investigation by my colleague Mark Walker, who found that there is a pretty substantial wait time for those with mental illnesses who are in the criminal justice system. It's creating a really heavy financial burden for county jails and for other institutions in the state. So overall, there's been pretty good support for those proposals so far, but it'll be interesting to see whether lawmakers bring any amendments to those bills. But I would say they have a pretty strong supporting factor here in the legislature.
Seth, lawmakers carrying pistols. I don't know why I'm focusing on West River reporter there for that, but tag you're in.
Yeah, maybe. Well, yeah, I mean, this is an issue that's been in past legislatures. And, you know, I'd be interested to ask Dana a question on this. In the past, you know, when I've come to the Capitol, there never seemed to be any very much security there. And I've always found that interesting as far as at the door. And when you go into the Pennington County Courthouse, they only allow you to go into one entrance, and every day there's two deputies there and a metal detector, under the theory that obviously if somebody's going to try to bring a weapon into the courthouse, they're gonna disarm that person on their way in. And so, you know, I've always found that interesting that some legislators have wanted to take an opposite approach, which is, you know, less focus on initial security and more focus on, well, let's just let everybody bring guns in and, you know, shoot the bad guys or whatever. So I'd be curious from Dana, somebody who's there, you know, daily at the Capitol, you know, what the security is like these days, you know, like at the door. And is there any more focus on that?
Yeah, on a daily basis, there's not really any heightened security going on here during the legislative session. We see some highway patrol officers or guards stationed during some of the bigger days of session. Last week when the Senate voted to repeal initiated Measure 22, there was definitely a heightened presence of security here in the Capitol. But on the whole, there isn't a very visible security force here, whereas in other state capitals, I know some have metal detectors, as do many courthouses in the state, or just different ways of monitoring security in the building. Obviously, this became a pretty big subject of conversation earlier in the week when Representative Roden tested out the panic button during committee and essentially made the point that no one was there quick enough to potentially prevent any sort of threat to lawmakers or others. Obviously,
that backfired, though, didn't it?
It didn't backfire. It worked for him in that the bill was able to pass, and it'll come up on the House floor today.
Yeah, but wasn't there an armed guard already in the room, and they brought up the...
He was testifying at that moment, too. So security at the Capitol said, we saw that happened. We were able to scan the video and saw that there was no real threat. There was a guard there in the room, so it wasn't something we were going to call in additional guards for. So I think to some degree, Representative Roden would argue it helped make his point. The security staff here at the Capitol would say it's not 100% true that they wouldn't be able to respond within a matter of seconds. But I guess that debate is going to carry out later on this afternoon in the House. So we'll see if that was as effective as he would have liked.
Okay, Dana Ferguson with the Sioux Falls Argus Leader and Seth Tupper, Rapid City Journal reporter. Thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mads Tolling is one of the top violinists on today's jazz scene, and he spent nearly a decade with both the Turtle Island String Quartet and bassist Stanley Clark's band before forming his own groups. And his latest band, Mads Tolling and the Mads Men, has just released a new album, Playing the 60s. It's a collection of jazz arrangements of American popular music from the 1960s, including theme songs from television shows like Hawaii Five-O and the Flintstones. Mads Tolling and the Mads Men are performing in Sioux Falls Thursday evening at the Washington Pavilion. The concert showcases music from Playing the 60s. Tolling was born in Denmark in 1980 and moved to the U.S. at the age of 20 to study jazz at the Berklee College of Music in Boston. He tells SDPB's Jazz Nightly host Carl Gerke that while growing up in Copenhagen in the 80s and 90s, he was familiar with American pop music from the 60s.
I actually was. You know, that's the thing. I grew up in Denmark and in Europe in general, so much of the stuff that people watch on TV is American TV shows, American movies, and I just find that the music in those TV shows can be a little underrated, you know, and people don't think about it, oh, you know, that's just part of the introduction music, but there's actually some great music in there that I just love to feature in this album, like, you know, I grew up watching Meet the Flintstones, for example, and was singing along to that introduction music. And, for example, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which is also on the album, that whole soundtrack just leaves such a big impression on you, especially when you're, 14 years old. And so that's kind of part of the inspiration of doing this album this way.
Is there something about this music that makes it special, that there are certain qualities to it that really attract you as a musician?
Well, I think doing these tracks in a slightly different way was what attracted me, because certainly everybody, or nearly everybody, will know how The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly goes. But, you know, if you twist it around and add this sort of reggae beat to it, and of course then you have the violin, or in this case the octave violin, which is a violin that goes an octave lower, then you have a totally new take on this classic tune that a lot of people wouldn't think about. But yet it's possible to do, and I think musically it all kind of adds up and makes sense. So it's taking these classic songs that everybody knows and then twisting them around and showing a different side of them.
How did you come up with the arrangements? For example, that reggae groove you have going on The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, is this something that you and the whole band worked out together?
It is something that we work out as a band a lot of times and tweak things. But the unique thing about this album was that everybody in the band contributed arrangements. And this particular arrangement was actually made by our bassist, Sam Bevan. And so he brought this to the table particularly inspired by a Malayan rhythm, you know, so really an African rhythm. A lot of the, Caribbean types of beats are very much related to African music. So that's what he came with. And then that octave violin that sounds a little bit like a guitar with all the plucking, that's really what kind of is the backbone of running the piece and running the groove that happens in that. So yeah, it's a group collaboration of coming up with all these arrangements. Thank you.
Now, you mentioned Caribbean groove, and you have that, I think, on Bob Dylan's All Along the Watchtower.
Yes, that certainly is very clear, clearly Afro-Cuban in that one. And that was not surprising. If you listen to the whole arrangement, wonderful arrangement by Colin Hogan, the pianist in the group, and he was able to take some of that that ostinato that is so driving in the Bob Dylan song and Jimi Hendrix version as well, and kind of put the Afro-Cuban sounds to it, the salsa sounds, and then on top of that, having a little bit from the Jimi Hendrix improvised solo is in the arrangement, taking the cab, because apparently Bob Dylan says after he heard the Jimi Hendrix version, I'm not going to play that tune anymore, that's Jimmy's at this point. So now we have yet another version of that one.
And you also tackle Hawaii Five-O, and we know that as a theme song being very up-tempo, and you slow it down a little bit.
Yeah, it has a little bit of that contemplative side to it, and I think, having it in five is interesting, to keep the time signature of five, and a different harmony that goes out throughout it. So a lot of times, that's something you can do with these songs because they're fairly simple in terms of the harmonic structure of them, is you can go and change that and make it interesting and new that way. And that's really what happened on Hawaii 5-0.
So these were songs that were easily adaptable to these different arrangements and being in a more or less jazz context?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually what it turned out to be. And I think that's, ultimately, the truth of it is you can take any piece of music, and if you add find the right balance and the right spice, so to speak, you can make tunes into something different and still have people realize that that's the tune, but we're doing something, we're shedding a little bit of new light on the tune. And I think Hawaii Five-O was a great example of that. Really, a very nice bass solo too by Sam that he takes there. So over some pretty challenging harmony, not quite the level of John Coltrane's Giant Steps or something like that, but certainly has some interest to it.
Along with the songs that you rework quite a bit, there are a few that stick pretty closely to the original recordings,
yeah,
and versions. For example, you do Henry Mancini's The Pink Panther, and it almost sounds to me like when you're playing the opening melody on your violin that you're getting a little bit of that gritty saxophone that we're so familiar that plays the Pink Panther theme.
Yeah, that's right. That was an interesting one because I ended up using... I think I played the viola on that one. So I play on this album the violin, the viola, and the octave violin. And the viola is actually in between the octave violin and the regular violin. So it has that deep sound, and I think that was played on a tenor sax. And so I needed a little bit of a lower instrument, and then really tipping the cap to the original arrangement was also going out on it, where I play this kind of hazy sound on the violin, a little bit of a natural distortion on the instrument, and that was because the flute that plays it out, and so I wanted to have a little bit close to that sound of the flute. So it sounds a little flute-like, I feel, when the way I try to do that, and that's played on a regular violin. But certainly that arrangement is quite close to the original, and I love the Henry Mancini shout chorus, the big band shout chorus that happens and a lot of people are familiar with the, of course, the Pink Panther regular theme, but the Shao chorus is something that is less played, so we thought we would include that in our version.
You mentioned earlier Meet the Flintstones, a television program that you knew growing up in Denmark, and that theme song is something that I think probably everybody knows, can sing along with it. And what's interesting about that song is it's based on the chord changes to I Got Rhythm, which is at the foundation of so many jazz compositions. And so you take Meet the Flintstones, you put a little bit of I Got Rhythm in there, and this is an opportunity for the band to just cut loose and improvise, isn't it?
Oh, totally. Yeah, this is just a good old up-tempo, swinging kind of arrangement of Meet the Flintstones. And the neat thing about it, too, is we start off freewheeling the bass and the violin, pizzicatoing together, kind of riffing off each other, just improvising. And people think, you know, what the heck is going on here? That doesn't sound like anything I know. And then all of a sudden we break into this song that virtually everybody knows, and it's kind of a fun moment, you know, because of that surprise element there that happens.
So audiences, you know, they probably smile and shout with recognition when they hear that familiar song.
It's definitely a good icebreaker, right? Because we like to have that fairly early, and people go, "Oh, this is going to be really out there," and then people realize, "No, we know that song again." That little bit of familiarity that people like to hold on to, I think, and it's fun for us to have that a part of the show.
Listening to In the Moment from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. I'm talking with violinist Mads Tolling. He's just released a new album with his band, The Mads Men. It's called Playing the 60s. Tolling and the band are in Sioux Falls tomorrow evening for a concert at the Washington Pavilion. And Mads Tolling, the final track on the album isn't a song associated with television or pop songs of the 1960s. This is a hymn, Beautiful Savior, and you're joined by Stanley Clark. Why did you include this tune on this album?
Well, 1860. Uh-huh. I love to say that a little teasing, but it's still the 60s, almost, because I think, well, first of all, it's an old song from northern Germany that was actually from Schleswig-Holstein, which is used to be part of Denmark, but now it's officially German, but so that's where the song was first kind of happened, I guess. And then there was this very famous text writer, sort of contemporary to Hans Christian Andersen. His name was Ingemann, who wrote some lyrics to him that are still very used in the northern part, Lutheran part of Europe there. And people use that text, beautiful text that he wrote. And that was like 1860s. But anyways, it's a song that really rings home for me because it was one that I sang every Christmas. It's more known as a Christmas carol over there, or Christmas psalm. And so we would sing that Christmas time. And so it's a song that is very dear to me. And I just figured I would include that since I had that recorded with Stanley Clark from a little bit before. So just thought it was a nice closer to the album, has that very acoustic sound, and as Stanley's playing is beautiful on it. And I was part of Stanley Clark's band for 8 years touring around with him, so it kind of, for me, goes back to how I first got into playing music professionally when I first moved to this country, so I figured we'd be a good closer.
You started playing with Stanley Clark. Was this around the time that you graduated from Berklee?
That's right, yeah. The story goes that I had a little visit from the great violinist Jean-Luc Ponty. He went to Berklee College of Music, taught a master class. I jumped up on stage and played with him, and he was very nice to me. And a year went by or so, and then all of a sudden I got a phone call from him saying, I hope you don't mind, but I've given your name to Stanley Clark, and he's putting a band together. And I said, I don't mind at all. So that was the connection there with going basically right from school, even before I graduated, starting touring with one of the absolute greats of jazz. And I was very, very fortunate to have that opportunity.
You played with the Turtle Island String Quartet for a number of years, and this is a group that's known for its eclectic approach to music, classical to jazz. I think you played on the Love Supreme John Coltrane album,
right,
that the group put out. What did you learn from being in that group as it relates to the music that you make now with your own bands?
I learned so much from being in that group because it felt a little bit like it was that was always my main gig, was being in Turtle Island Quartet. And so I learned, became a better player as a result. All these special techniques that we do to create rhythm in a string quartet, because there is no drums, there is no bass. We have a cello, and then we have two violins and a viola, just like Mozart or Haydn wrote for. So we had to come up with our own approach and our own way of creating rhythm, because we were, as you mentioned, we did Love Supreme, John Coltrane. And to do that kind of music, you need to create a groove a lot of times. So I learned a lot from doing that through the years. And then I learned a lot about arranging and composing as well, because that's such an integral part of being in the string quartet, is having great arrangements. And then lastly, of course, learning about how to run a group like a business and how to, you know, make good decisions and always keep an interesting programming. You know, you can't just say, I play really well and I play really interesting music, original music. That can be cool, but it's a lot of times it's very helpful to have some kind of program, some kind of hook that gives people an idea of what this is going to be and something to for people to hold on to. And I think doing that with Turtle Island for that many years, where we always did collaborations with, say, Kenny Barron or Paquito de Rivera, really helped me form this sense of, okay, this is how it is to run a group and how to do it in a smart and an interesting way.
Now, this album, Playing the 60s, was it as much fun to make as it sounds like it was?
Yeah, that it was fun to make. And of course, when you're in the situation of rehearsing and putting things together, you go through a lot of you know, saying, oh, no, I don't think that works, and we should really do it that way, and then somebody else has a different opinion. And that's really how you, to me, make a band happen, because, you know, it's that little bit of coming to the same, you know, aesthetically having slightly different ideas and then coming to some kind of agreement and some kind of middle ground that makes it interesting to be a musician, is that search for the best way to do things as a unit that makes it fun. So it was a lot of fun to make. And yeah, we had some great recording times at Fantasy Studios here in Berklee, California. That also has a lot of great memories. Creedence Clearwater recorded there, and Santana and all these people. So very, very fortunate to be able to do that and have, I think, a good product that came out of it.
Violinist Mads Tolling and his band, the Mads Men, are featuring music from the new album Playing the 60s Thursday evening at the Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls. The concert begins at 7 o'clock. Tickets are available at the Washington Pavilion box office. Tolling spoke with SDPB's Jazz Nightly host, Carl Gerke. And welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Kara Hetland in today for Lori Walsh. Thanks so much for tuning in. And joining me now in our studio in Vermilion is Glenn Wilmot. He is speaking today at the University of South Dakota. His topic is titled The Politics of Reading for Wonder. And Glenn Wilmot is with the Department of English, a professor in English and Cultural Studies at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Glenn Wilmot, thanks so much for being with us today.
Hi, Kara. Thanks. It's great to be here.
So let's begin. Let's start with a little definition of what wonder is.
Well, wonder really, I think it's an amazing kind of, well, it's a wondrous kind of feeling. It's unusual, I think, among all the emotions we can think of, like joy or anger or sadness. It has a kind of an emotional feeling about it. I think if you're looking at something and you don't feel wonder, then that's also, wonder demands a kind of emotional response, but it's also a kind of sensual or aesthetic response. It's the wow of seeing something like a rainbow. And on top of all that, it's also thoughtful. It kind of stops you in your tracks with something you don't really understand fully. It makes you think. So it combines all those things, thinking, feeling, looking, and it's kind of complex and interesting that way.
It's not just being curious.
No, I think there's curiosity in wonder, but I think it's that that feeling of a big wow, looking at something that engages all your senses and really takes you outside of yourself. That curiosity can do. If curiosity has that big impact and has that emotional feeling and a feeling of kind of opening doors and taking you out of your tracks a little bit, then I think that curiosity can become wonder in that way.
And then what is the politics of reading for wonder?
Well, a lot of writers about wonder, philosophers and others, have talked about wonder as a kind of building block or a kind of a way station towards developing feelings of compassion. And I think that, the political life, our understanding of politics, our understanding of ourselves as citizens, I think really depends on developing and cultivating compassion for others who are maybe very close to us or very far away and may seem very different cultures or paths in life that we may be unfamiliar with. So being part of a big, complex society, I think compassion is an important emotion. And wonder has been linked to compassion and to empathy by philosophers and also child psychologists, developmental psychologists.
Is wonder something that we are taught, or is it just come natural to us?
Yeah, that's a good question. There isn't actually a lot of, there's been quite a long philosophical tradition about wonder, going way back to Plato and Aristotle, people who said that knowledge, philosophy begins in wonder. But what it actually is as a psychological experience has only really been studied in the past 10 years or so. So it's hard to say, but it seems to be wonder and awe seem to be a kind of, at least partly, a kind of innate innate capacity that we carry with us. But it certainly needs to be developed and cultivated in education so that we wonder at different things. We might be educated to maybe attend to and listen to and develop our own capacity for wonder. kind of like exercising your muscles.
Well, how do you cultivate wonder, especially in the educational system, perhaps?
Well, you know, I first got interested in wonder when kind of just working on other things. I read about a psychologist talking about animals in classrooms, in children's classrooms. And his interest was in how animals in classrooms drew a kind of wonder and fascination from children that had a connection to their learning. It had a connection to empathy and compassion, but also a connection to learning. And I wondered, you know, how does, if it's that important, then how has art and literature done that? Has art and literature really devoted itself to trying to, in a sense, artificially build wonder experiences for us? And I think it has done. It's created immersive experiences that kind of suspend us or take us out of our real life. It's created kind of estranging effects for us, that we are sort of bumped into looking at things in a new light. So our art has kind of, and some kinds of popular culture have tried to take us out of our ordinary life and see things in a new way, even if it's only in an imaginary things that we're thinking about.
And so when you talk about wonder in art, give me some examples. Give me something to grasp here.
Okay. Well, a great, in my world of literature, a great American example is Melville's, you know, fantastic novel, Moby Dick, which is premised on a very mundane thing at the time, like this substance, whale oil. It was just a fuel, and the need for it, the need to go out in factory ships and find and kill animals to produce this. But Melville comes along and he turns that whole process and turns the animal, the whale, into an incredibly mysterious other life that he becomes fascinated with and his readers become fascinated with, and leads him to all kinds of questions about what the nature of animals are, what the nature of human beings are. So wonder tends to open outwards in those kinds of ways. A closer example might be the magic of a film like La La Land, which many of us have seen now, and that's the way it's talked about constantly, a kind of a re-enchantment, a kind of a magic experience. And for me, a lot of that has to do with kind of wondering about how that, you know, song and dance kind of comes out of the characters. Can it come out of us? We want it to come out of us. Why doesn't it, or how does it? And I think it leads us to wonder about those things too.
So taking more time and looking for that wow factor in our world, perhaps?
Yeah, I think time is a big issue for wonder. Wonder is it's a slow experience. It's hard to slow down for wonder. In some ways, we are living in a world in which kind of kinds of enchantment and magic are all around us, being produced by a kind of entertainment industry. But much of that doesn't slow down to actually encourage us to think very far.
Why should we care about wonder?
Well, I think for me that goes back to the connection between wonder and empathy and compassion, that when we slow down and we look at something in a new way and sort of put aside whatever our goals and purposes were for that moment, just sort of stunned by something as simple as a rainbow, or maybe in a zoo or looking at a very unusual animal that we don't understand. I think that it encourages us, wonder encourages us to think about kind of the aims and powers of other things in our environment. What are other things doing? If they're living things, then we'll will wonder, what are they? Are they like people? Like the children back in the classrooms who say, he likes me, or she's hiding in her corner about animals, you know. This mysterious sense that there's a kind of personhood or life force in things that we need to attend to. And I think that can be a very enriching and slow experience that can change how we think about what we don't know about other things in our world.
So if we take and acknowledge the wonder, the wow, is that enough, or do we then need to take it to the next step and understand the why behind the wonder?
Yeah, I think that we do, and I think that when artists or people in various kinds of aspects of culture, popular culture or high art, when they're interested in trying to produce wonder, I think they're trying to get us to take wonder away with us and think more about things and change us in some way. I think that can be very hard. Sometimes the effect of wonder can be more just sort of an awestruck or spellbound kind of experience that might even just leave us thinking, wow, I have no words for that, and I can't even think about it. And in that case, I guess wonder might have given a kind of a thrill, but might have failed in some sense.
Glenn Wilmot, I want to thank you for taking time and coming on the program today and having this conversation with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Glenn Wilmot presents The Politics of Reading for Wonder today at 4 o'clock at Farber Hall, Old Main on the University of South Dakota campus. And he is the professor in English and Cultural Studies at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, joining us in the moment.